It is an impeachable offense for the president to exercise the powers of his public office to obtain an improper personal benefit while ignoring or injuring the national interest. That is exactly what President Trump did when he solicited and pressured Ukraine to interfere in our 2020 presidential election, thus damaging our national security, undermining the integrity of the next election, and violating his oath to the American people. These actions, moreover, are consistent with President Trump's previous invitations of foreign interference in our 2016 presidential election. And when he was caught, when the House investigated and opened an impeachment inquiry, President Trump engaged in unprecedented, categorical, and indiscriminate defiance of the impeachment inquiry. This gives rise to the second article of impeachment for obstruction of Congress. Here, too, we see a familiar pattern in President Trump's misconduct. A president who declares himself above accountability, above the American people, and above Congress's power of impeachment, which is meant to protect against threats to our democratic institutions, is a president who sees himself as above the law. We must be clear, no one, not even the president, is above the law. I want to recognize the great contributions of the investigative chairs, particularly Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, Foreign Affairs Chairman Elliot Engel, Committee on Oversight and Reform's former chairman, the late Elijah Cummings, and its new chairwoman, Carolyn Maloney, Financial Services Chairwoman Maxine Waters, and Ways and Means Chairman Richard Neal, who helped lay the foundation for the articles we are introducing today. I also want to thank my Judiciary Committee colleagues who were critical in our work to hold the president accountable and in the drafting of these articles. Later this week, the Judiciary Committee will meet to consider these articles of impeachment and to make a recommendation to the full House of Representatives. We do not take this action lightly, but we have taken an oath to defend the Constitution. And unlike President Trump, we understand that our duty, first and foremost, is to protect the Constitution and to protect the interests of the American people. That is why we must take this solemn step today. Elections are the cornerstone of democracy and are foundational to the rule of law. But the integrity of our next election is at risk from a president who has already sought foreign interference in the 2016 and 2020 elections and who consistently puts himself above country. That is why we must act now. I want to turn now to Chairman Schiff, who will explain the evidence that supports these articles and the need for us to act with such urgency today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Madam Speaker, and to my colleagues, good morning. The framers of the Constitution recognized that someday a president might come to office who would abuse that office, betray the public trust, and undermine national security to secure foreign help in his reelection, and who would seek to abrogate the power of Congress to hold him accountable. They recognized this danger, and they prescribed a remedy, and that remedy is impeachment. It is an extraordinary remedy and one that I've been reluctant to recommend until the actions of President Trump gave Congress no alternative. We stand here today because the president's continuing abuse of his power has left us no choice. To do nothing would make ourselves complicit in the president's abuse of his high office, the public trust, and our national security. The president's misconduct is as simple and as terrible as this. President Trump solicited a foreign nation, Ukraine, to publicly announce investigations into his opponent and a baseless conspiracy theory promoted by Russia to help his reelection campaign. President Trump abused the power of his office by conditioning two official acts to get Ukraine to help his reelection: the release of hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid that nation desperately needed, and a White House meeting with an ally trying to fend off Russian aggression. In so doing, he undermined our national security and jeopardized the integrity of our next election. And he does so still. The evidence of the president's misconduct is overwhelming and uncontested. And how could it not be when the president's own words on July 25th, "I would like you to do us a favor, though," lays so bare his intentions, his willingness to sacrifice the national security for his own personal interests. And when the president got caught, he committed his second impeachable act, obstruction of Congress, of the very ability to make sure that no one is above the law, not even the president of the United States. The evidence is every bit as strong that President Trump has obstructed Congress fully, without precedent, and without basis in law. If allowed to stand, it would decimate Congress's ability to conduct oversight of this president or any other in the future, leaving this president and those who follow to be free to be as corrupt, malfeasant, or incompetent as they would like, with no prospect of discovery or accountability. Now, some would argue, why don't you just wait? Why don't you just wait until you get these witnesses the White House refuses to produce? Why don't you just wait until you get the documents the White House refuses to turn over? And people should understand what that argument really means. It has taken us 8 months to get a lower court ruling that Don McGahn has no absolute right to defy Congress. 8 months. For one court decision. If it takes us another 8 months to get a second court or maybe a Supreme Court decision, people need to understand that is not the end of the process. It comes back to us and we ask questions because he no longer has absolute immunity, and then he claims something else, that his answers are privileged and we have to go back to court for another 8 or 16 months. The argument, why don't you just wait, amounts to this. Why don't you just let him cheat in one more election? Why not let him cheat just one more time? Why not let him have foreign help just one more time? That is what that argument amounts to. The president's misconduct goes to the heart of whether we can conduct a free and fair election in 2020. It is bad enough for a candidate to invite foreign interference in our political process, but it is far more corrosive for a president to do so and to abuse his power to make it so. Despite everything we have uncovered, the president's misconduct continues to this day, unapologetically and right now. As we saw when he stood on the White House lawn and he was asked, what did you want in that July 25th call? And he said the answer was a simple one. And not just a simple one on July 25th, but a simple one today, and that is he still wants Ukraine to interfere in our election to help his campaign. Even this week, the president's lawyer was back in Ukraine seeking to revive the same debunked conspiracy theory promoted at the president's behest. Which gets to the final and most pernicious of the arguments that we have heard in the president's defense. That the president can do whatever he wants under Article 2, including get foreigners involved in our elections, and we should just, to quote the president's chief of staff, get over it. Ben Franklin said, we have a republic if we can keep it. The president and his men say, you can't keep it, and Americans should just get over it. Americans don't get to decide American elections anymore. Not by themselves, not without foreign help. For the members of Congress, this is not a question of fact because the facts are not seriously contested. It is rather a question of duty. The president's oath of office appears to mean very little to him, but the articles put forward today will give us a chance to show that we will defend the Constitution and that our oath means something to us. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR of the latest the latest step in the impeachment inquiry. We just heard Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi introduce her committee chairs, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, also the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. Those two men have been leading the investigation into President Trump and whether or not he committed impeachable offenses. And we heard there those committee chairmen outline the content of the articles of impeachment. There will be two articles, one on abuse of power, and a second article of impeachment will relate to obstruction of justice. So let's talk about what that means, the consequences of that. I am joined in studio by NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe, also NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson. We also have NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell is on Capitol Hill. Mara, I want to turn to you first. What did you make of what you heard there?
Well, we now know that the House has decided to keep this pretty narrow to just two articles, abuse of power. He solicited a foreign nation, Ukraine, to publicly announce an investigation into his opponent, something that would help him, that was not congruent with the foreign policy of the United States. But also, I think the second article, which is one that's probably less salient with the public but is more serious, which is this separation of powers clash, that he obstructed Congress, that If the Democrats said if this is allowed to stand, then Congress's ability to conduct oversight of the executive branch is decimated. In other words, the check and balance of two co-equal branches of government will be obliterated. And other presidents have clashed with Congress, have refused to turn over witnesses and documents. But the argument that the Democrats are making is that they never did this in such a categorical way. Usually other presidents kind of negotiate something in the end, but this is across the board, no documents, no witnesses. And if you think Donald Trump or the Trump presidency is a stress test on democratic institutions, certainly the Democrats feel that he is in this case and that he'd be undermining a pretty important one.
Ayesha?
And I think that that argument is very real, regardless of what happens with impeachment. I do wonder, and I think it's something that this country is going to have to deal with, why would a president or future presidents comply with investigations from Congress? Like, if you can't, if you don't have to, if you can get away with it, I don't think any president or administration likes to be investigated. Why would you turn over evidence? Why would you turn over documents? I think that's a real question going forward for this country and what will happen with future presidents.
It's a real affirmation of executive power in this case. Kelsey, I want to ask you this whole idea that if President Trump is not held accountable, as Democrats say he needs to be, for what they point to as impeachable offenses, in particular obstruction of Congress in this investigation, is that something Republicans talk about? Do they raise the concern that by not holding President Trump accountable, that this will somehow undermine the institution that they represent?
It's really interesting because this is something that we have been exploring with Republicans for more than a year. We've talked to many of them about their feelings about the separation of powers eroding with each new president. And they do feel that in some ways that President Trump has gone around Congress. They talk about things that he did, like appointing acting people into positions of power instead of having them confirm, like secretaries of different agencies. They feel very uncomfortable with Trump's actions, but they never go as far as Democrats in what they want to do to kind of keep Trump reined in. They never want to take actual steps to keep Trump from using the powers the way he wants to use them. I do think it's really interesting, too, that they didn't really reference Robert Mueller or his reports, but they did talk about the foundation of a pattern of conduct that members have been discussing. They want to vote on articles that make clear the president's actions with regard to Ukraine didn't happen in isolation. Jerry Nadler, the Judiciary Committee chairman, called it a pattern of misconduct of inviting foreign interference in our elections. And that is something they want to make clear when they vote. Is that this is about a pattern of the president, not just what he did in Ukraine.
Kelsey, we actually have a clip of Chairman Nadler. Let's listen to this. We're still waiting on that clip of Chairman Jerry Nadler, but reaffirming some of what you just said about his arguments in about how the president has abused his power, has obstructed Congress, and the long-term damage that could do to the democracy. I want to turn instead to the Republicans' arguments here, because we heard these laid out yesterday in front of the Judiciary Committee. Stephen Castor was the attorney who was representing the Republicans' point of view. Let's hear him articulate the Republican defense.
The record in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry does not show that President Trump abused the power of his office or obstructed Congress. To impeach a president who 63 million people voted for over eight lines in a call transcript is baloney.
I mean, Mara, we hear Stephen Castor there pointing to eight lines in the transcript. The White House released the summary of that July 25th phone call with President Trump. But Adam Schiff pointed out ten words, rather. I would like you to do us a favor, though.
That's right. For the Democrats, the mere ask was enough. That, as Schiff said, President Trump solicited a foreign nation to publicly announce an investigation into his opponent, thereby helping him in the next election. That's enough for the Democrats. For the Republicans, they've put the bar much higher. They're saying he has to have explicitly said, if you don't do this, I will not give you military aid. Mm-hmm. And also, the Republicans say it's just eight lines. Democrats would say we've had hours and hours of testimony that witness after witness corroborated the initial whistleblower account and went beyond that. No one has contradicted what the president said in that transcript. And what's really interesting is the president decided to release the transcript, even though the Democrats are accusing him of unprecedented, categorical, indiscriminate defiance. He released that transcript because he thought it was exculpatory. In other words, he didn't do it because he respected Congress's oversight Article One powers.
He thought it would clear it up
because it showed him being polite. I'd like to ask you a favor, not I'm going to break your legs. But it turned out not to have that effect.
I want to play some more tape of what we just heard. We've got that clip now. This is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler.
Throughout this inquiry, he has attempted to conceal the evidence from Congress and from the American people. Our president holds the ultimate public trust. When he betrays that trust and puts himself before country, he endangers the Constitution, he endangers our democracy, and he endangers our national security.
And now this from the House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff.
The evidence is every bit as strong that President Trump has obstructed Congress fully, without precedent, and without basis in law. If allowed to stand, it would decimate Congress's ability to conduct oversight of this president or any other in the future, leaving this president and those who follow to be free to be as corrupt, malfeasant, or incompetent as they would like, with no prospect of discovery or accountability.
So will this move Republicans in a Senate trial? Kelsey.
It is hard for me to see how it will move many Republicans, if any. This is something that, like, as I said, they do have some discomfort with the president's unwillingness to participate in the norms and even the regulations of the way that the White House is supposed to behave with relation to Congress. They have never been able to identify what they want to do about it. And for many of them, impeachment is a bridge far too far for them to get on board. They have a lot of voters who still support this president.
You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News. We heard the Democratic committee chairs outline two articles of impeachment against President Donald J. Trump. This is special coverage from NPR News.
Many Democrats' views on Medicare for All are drawn from their personal experiences with the healthcare system.
Some insurances won't cover them. Some insurances will cover half.
The sensor that I have for my insulin pump is not covered by Medicare.
I don't have any healthcare at all.
The divide on Medicare for All this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio with Hannah Haynes sitting in for Brady Carlson.
There was a time when high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin. Some people loved the idea.
So there were all these ideas, wants and desires and needs in the community that seemed to get tied together in this neat package.
But the project had its critics.
It was a bright, shiny object, but ultimately failed the test of common sense.
Derailed is a new podcast from WPR, where we explore what this train says about our increasingly divided state.
It's available now wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Moments ago, House Democrats announced they're moving forward with their impeachment of President Trump.
The House Committee on the Judiciary is introducing two articles of impeachment, charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
That's House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler of New York speaking at a news conference alongside House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democratic lawmakers. The articles of impeachment are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, stemming from Trump's July phone call with the president of Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin is threatening to expel German diplomats after Germany expelled two employees at Russia's embassy in Berlin. Here's NPR's Rob Schmitz.
Germany expelled Russian embassy employees last week over Moscow's failure to cooperate in the investigation of the murder of a former Chechen commander in a Berlin park in August. Germany's highest prosecutor says there is sufficient evidence the murder was carried out by the Russian government. Putin denies any involvement, describing the murdered man as a bandit and killer. He said Russia's request to extradite him had not been heeded. He added, though, that Moscow is ready to assist in the investigation. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she'd raise the issue with Putin during their bilateral talks in Paris, urging for Moscow to cooperate. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The two passenger trains the state of Wisconsin ordered more than a decade ago are coming back to Milwaukee, if only for a little while, Bridget Bowden reports.
Former Democratic Governor Jim Doyle's administration ordered the trains from Spanish manufacturer Talgo in 2009. They were supposed to run on Amtrak's Hiawatha line between Milwaukee and Chicago. But when Republicans took control of state government after the 2010 election, the state breached its contract with the company. The two sides settled. Wisconsin paid $50 million, and Talgo got to keep the trains. They've been stored at an Amtrak facility in Beech Grove, Indiana, for the past 5 years. Spokespeople for Amtrak and Talgo confirmed that the trains are now in Milwaukee at Talgo's maintenance facility. While nothing is final, they could potentially be moved to the Pacific Northwest to run on an Amtrak line through Washington and Oregon. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For more information on the Talgo story, visit WPR.org/derailed. The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire will seek an outside review of the athletics department after a racist incident involving members of the football team. In November, five players used Ku Klux Klan imagery to mock a black male empowerment student group. During a press conference Monday, athletics director Dan Schumacher called it, quote, reprehensible.
This gives us a chance to get better, and it'll move us forward, and it'll make it easier to have good conversations when it relates to this topic. This type of adversity makes us stronger.
UW-Eau Claire also created what it's calling a rapid response task force to recommend ways to improve equity, diversity, and inclusion on campus. Former Milwaukee Brewers catcher Ted Simmons has been elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Simmons joined Milwaukee in 1981 as part of a blockbuster trade that also brought in Hall of Fame pitcher Raleigh Fingers. The Brewers went to their first playoffs that year. In 1982, Milwaukee made its first and only World Series appearance. Simmons hit two home runs in that series before the Brewers ultimately lost to the St. Louis Cardinals.
That was kind of a golden era for the team, and Ted Simmons was a big part of it.
That's Tom Hodricourt. He's a Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Simmons retired as a player more than 30 years ago. He's the seventh Brewer to be elected to the Hall of Fame. This is news from WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org. From the Candida Fund, supporting individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at KENDEDAFund.org. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Russia's foreign minister drops by Washington today. He meets President Trump, whose story touches Russia again and again. Investigators established that Russia assisted Trump's 2016 election. Russia's war with Ukraine is the backdrop of an impeachment inquiry. President Trump took a dim view of Russia's enemy and withheld U.S. military aid to Ukraine while seeking political favors. Now the war in Ukraine could pause. The presidents of Russia and Ukraine met yesterday and agreed to a ceasefire. The meeting was in Paris, which is where we find NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Hi there, Eleanor.
Good morning, Steve.
What was this meeting like?
Well, you know, it went on for hours and hours and didn't break up until after midnight. So here's this press conference, you know, after midnight. You had this young neophyte politician, Volodymyr Zelensky, meeting with the strongman who's run Russia for 20 years, Vladimir Putin, and continues to create havoc in Ukraine. So everyone is watching body language and faces. And Zelensky and Putin were at the far ends of the table, separated by their mediators, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron. Zelensky spoke first, right after the host, Macron, and he appeared nervous, but what he said seemed heartfelt. Here he is. You can hear him. So he said he had all of Ukrainians with him in Paris, and he felt their support. He said he also had truth with him and the desire for justice and peace in his own country. He said the meetings were long, but they were concrete and important, and that the dialogue had been unblocked. Zelensky also asserted that Ukraine is an independent and free country, and its future will be decided by Ukrainians. And he asserted that Donbass, that's eastern Ukraine, and Crimea are part of Ukraine. Remember, Russia took Crimea 5 years ago and is still destabilizing eastern Ukraine.
Well, what exactly did they agree on then, given that Russian forces still control a lot of Ukraine?
Right. Well, they agreed on a ceasefire before the end of the year, but I might add that there have been 20 ceasefires in this war, so will it hold? But what was really important and is very concrete and measurable is they agreed to exchange all prisoners before New Year's Eve, so that will be measurable. And also they agreed by next March to withdraw forces from three major conflict zones, and this crisis group is going to meet again in 4 months.
When you say crisis group, it includes Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, the host of this meeting in Paris, where you are. What is his perspective on all this?
Well, France has taken a lead role in trying to solve this situation. Macron has actually spoken recently of getting a new dynamic between the West and Russia, you know, retying Russia to Europe. He wants a reset, and it's actually one of the things that Macron and President Trump agree upon. Also, you know what, Steve? Macron needs a win. He needs a win on the international stage. He's not in good shape at home. I don't know if you've heard, but there's huge strikes and protests in Paris, and there's going to be huge protests today against his pension overhaul. So I spoke with analyst Christian Macarion. He's editor of L'Express magazine, and here's what he said about the talks.
Macron needs something very concrete about Ukraine. And if there is someone who can help him, it's Zelensky, because Zelensky is also in a corner because of the Trump affair.
So, you know, he said they need each other. And you know what? You could see that, Steve. While Zelensky spoke, he would look down the table over at Macron, and Macron would look at him and smile. It was almost like a smile of encouragement. His guide, he was buttressing Zelensky, you know, encouraging him to keep going. It was very interesting.
Appreciate your observant eye, Eleanor. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
President Trump has long complained that the United States is a loser on the playing field of global trade. Now his administration is going after the ref. The United States is taking action to sideline the World Trade Organization, which has been the chief enforcer of global trading rules. Allies say the president simply wants to reform the organization. Critics say he is tearing it apart. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
You might not think the World Trade Organization would have much to say about solar rooftops in Connecticut, but it does. For years, Connecticut, like other states, has offered rebates to homeowners who invest in solar panels.
The goal was really to encourage adoption of residential solar projects.
Celia Price is with Connecticut's Green Bank, which runs the program. For a while, the state offered an extra incentive to homeowners who bought solar equipment that was made in Connecticut. Not many did. Nevertheless, India challenged that provision, along with similar buy local measures in other states, and the World Trade Organization ruled in India's favor, saying it's illegal for the U.S. to champion domestic products over foreign imports. President Trump complains that as an international trade referee, the WTO is taking advantage of the U.S.
We never used to win before me, because before me, the United States was a sucker.
In fact, since the WTO's founding, the U.S. has enjoyed a good track record of winning cases there. But as of today, the appellate body that decides those cases and rules on trade disputes between countries is losing its power. Term limits have left 6 out of 7 seats on the appellate body vacant, and the Trump administration is blocking the appointment of replacements. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer says the administration is fed up with an appellate body that drags its feet, makes its own rules, and fails to deal with trade challenges posed by countries like China.
We clearly need reform. Every other country, or almost every other country, has made this same point.
Previous administrations have raised similar complaints, but none has gone so far as to cripple the WTO's enforcement body. Carla Hills, who had Lighthizer's job in the first Bush administration, acknowledges the WTO needs modernizing to deal with 21st century challenges like digital trade and powerful state subsidies in China.
It's kind of like having an old house that didn't have a washing machine. It needed to be upgraded. That doesn't mean you knock down the house.
Hills warns that without a functioning appellate body to decide cases, countries may be tempted to ratchet up tariffs and make other hostile trade moves.
I think it's the law of the jungle.
From its inception in the 1990s, the WTO was designed to prevent big, powerful countries from throwing their weight around. Trump, however, likes the freedom to squeeze other countries and drive a hard bargain, just as he did in his business career. Veteran trade lawyer Scott Linsicum says whatever the shortcomings of the WTO, Trump is wrong to hamstring its enforcement arm.
The United States has long been a champion of the WTO, not only because it wins cases, but because it sees tremendous value in having a functioning multilateral trading system and a dispute settlement body.
Other observers are more sanguine about the president's tactics. Thomas Dusterberg, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, says with the trade referee sidelined, countries will simply have to negotiate their own agreements and perhaps work together to build a new trading framework.
I think in the long run, the interests not only of the United States and Europe, but also like-minded countries like Japan, Australia, Korea, will lead us to a point where we'll find a way.
In the meantime, the president will have more leeway to pursue trade policies he calls America First. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now it's 8:42. And coming up, South Korean director Bong Joon-ho is known for socially conscious horror movies. He's gained legions of fans worldwide for films like The Host and Snowpiercer. Now Parasite is winning awards and winning over film buffs with a story in part about the fragility of success. Stay with us. That's in 9 minutes.
What have you always wondered about Wisconsin, its people, or its culture?
What's the story behind House on the Rock?
Does Wisconsin really have more ghosts per square mile than any other state? What flavor is Blue Moon ice cream, anyway?
With Wisconsin, you ask the questions and we answer them. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin.
Support for WPR comes from Oakwood Village, committed to serving older adults on 2 Madison campuses, with a focus on building community through nature, the arts, and lifelong learning. More information is at oakwoodvillage.net.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, presenting the service of Lessons and Carols Friday, December 13th at 7 p.m. at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford, and the following Sunday at 3 p.m. at Racine Siena Center. Tickets are available in advance at choralartsonline.org.
8:44 now. Morning edition on WPR. Here are some of the major stories of the morning. Wildfires have engulfed Sydney, Australia, in haze so thick it's considered 11 times worse than the usual hazardous level and is apt to trigger fire alarms.
Local health officials advise people to stay indoors as much as possible. Weather forecasts showed a cold front might bring winds, but they would likely fan the fires raging along the New South Wales region. The Wisconsin DNR says 14 dams have failed in Wisconsin since 2008, eight of them after severe flooding last year. More on that story coming up in about 15 minutes here on WPR. A wind chill advisory is in effect for the northern half of Wisconsin tonight through noon Wednesday. Today, sunny in the south, partly cloudy in the rest of the state, highs from the low teens to low 20s, wind chills from 10 below to 25 below possible. For Wednesday, the weather pretty similar, except colder. Wind chills in the north might get down to 30 below zero.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA. Committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. We turn to art to try and process the world around us, the joys and the tragedies. Tonight, the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater will premiere a new dance piece in New York. It is called Ode. The choreographer says the work is an ode to gun violence in America, and it was inspired by the deaths of Trayvon Martin and others. Jeff London reports.
There are no gunshots in Ode, but it begins with one dancer lying motionless on the floor as a piano plays stark, detached chords. The dancer gets up and is eventually joined by five other dancers in flowing, circular motions. They dance together as an ensemble, but then one dancer falls and crumples to the floor. He's picked up by another dancer, but then two of them fall.
The inspiration for the piece was a couple years ago when there was this long stint of what appeared to be racially biased shootings by the police.
Jamar Roberts is the first resident choreographer for the Ailey Company and created this dance.
And that really disturbed me. And like, I start to think about, what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to me? What does it say about our world? What does it say about our community?
Ode is set to a solo jazz piano score by the late Don Pullen called Sweet, Sweet Malcolm, Part One, Memories and Gunshots.
You know, piano embodies the beautiful, the celestial, the sublime, but it also has like this percussiveness about it that I really like.
The piece has three distinct sections.
One being life, the middle section being death or despair, and the end section being afterlife or some type of resolution.
When Ode premieres tonight, six men will perform it. But in a couple of weeks, the same dance will be performed by an all-female cast. Gray DeVore Stokes is the soloist and had questions for the choreographer about the casting.
Once he told us what it was about victims and families and survivors of gun violence in America, we kind of understood the two dynamics. Because the female cast, of course, we're mothers, we're sisters, we're aunts, we're daughters, and also sometimes victims, but it is a predominantly male-centric issue.
Dancer Jeroboam Bozeman does the same steps with the all-male cast. He says some of the movement, particularly during the percussive middle section, is angular and intense, and some is in slow motion, but it's all very personal.
These things impact me as a black male and a dancer living in America. So having small imagery of bodies laying down slowly, I think of it as laying bodies to rest and kind of giving them that closure for them to ascend.
As he's worked on Ode, Jamar Roberts has not only coached the dancers on the steps, but the meaning behind them, paying homage to the lives lost and the survivors who carry on.
I think that art has power. I think it has the power to bring things to light, you know, and have people see the world in ways that they may not have seen. And dance says it without words. And I think that that is one of the most beautiful things about this art form, is that We don't use our words, but everybody knows exactly what the feeling is.
And audiences across America will be able to feel the power of Ode this winter as the Alvin Ailey Company takes it on tour. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Melissa Ingalls, right now about 10 minutes before 9. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll have news from NPR and WPR. And then Morning Classics, starting with an arrangement of the Wassail song by Rafe Vaughan Williams. Also this morning, Edvard Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite No. 2. And we'll hear some excerpts from A Ceremony of Carols by Benjamin Britten. All that and much more coming up.
Support comes from Lemon Street Gallery, presenting Artistry, their anticipated annual sale of original handcrafted local artwork, perfect for holiday gift giving. November 27th through December 14th, 4601 Sheridan Road, Kenosha, lemonstreetgallery.org.
Takes you on a journey through the issues and keeps you informed about all the campaigns. Listen every day from NPR News.
In sports, the Bucks beat the Orlando Magic last night 110-101 for their 15th straight win. Milwaukee hosts the New Orleans Pelicans tomorrow night. A wind chill advisory in effect for the northern half of Wisconsin tonight through noon Wednesday. Today, sunny in the south, partly cloudy in the rest of the state. Highs from the low teens to low 20s and wind chills from 10 below to 25 below possible. Wednesday, sunny in the south, cloudy in central and northern Wisconsin. Highs in the teens, wind chills in the north of the state from 20 to 30 below. And then on Thursday, rain and snow in the south, 3 to 5 inches of snow possible in the central and northern parts of the state. Highs from the mid-20s to low 30s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The hit film from South Korea, Parasite, has added 3 Golden Globe nominations to its growing list of accolades. The movie's director, Bong Joon-ho, is a rising star. And NPR's Netta Ulaby recently had a chance to sit down and talk with him about what this year, marking 100 years of Korean filmmaking, means.
I caught director Bong Joon-ho at the end of a hectic publicity push. This must have been his 100th interview in a week, he said. And he and his interpreter, Sharon Choi, were a little slap happy.
So with this interview, he wants to try not using any of the words he's been using so far?
Words director Bong is officially tired of include...
Class warfare. Very first idea and next project. And
Director Bong may also be getting tired of the word Oscar. It's widely speculated that Parasite could be the first ever foreign language film to win Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
Oh, 여기! 잡힌다!
진짜? 잡혔어?
This story about a rich family and a poor one sharing a house is already the year's highest grossing foreign language film. It's enraptured audiences partly for the actors' shining performances.
I set them free.
Director Bong Joon-ho says his style has everything to do with his predecessors.
Now
we've reached the 100th year of Korean cinema, and I hope people will discover that Korean cinema has also had a lot of masters.
Like who?
So many, 200, 300 of list of film, but 접근성이 제일 좋은 거 두 개만 소개할게요. 여러분들이 쉽게 구할 수 있는 거.
But I will introduce 2 films that are very accessible and easy to watch.
The Housemaid by Kim Ki-young, the 1960s master.
The Housemaid came out in 1960. It remains hugely influential. Director Bong Joon-ho says the story is...
something similar to The Parasite.
If you've seen Parasite, you may recognize the story of an upwardly mobile family with an interloper in the form of the family maid. Grady Hendrix has seen lots of Korean movies. He co-founded the New York Asian Film Festival.
And she's this disruptive influence who's poisoning people with rat poison and having an affair with the husband and killing the kids. And it's this real gothic nightmare. And that spawned several remakes. It was a big hit at the time. It's an enormously influential Korean movie.
And helped establish a genre to which Parasite belongs.
This sort of drama of domestic gothic.
Scheming maids, people locked in basements, or bloody birthday parties may reflect the anxieties of a country where families remain divided across borders and class mobility is relatively new. Still, says Grady Hendrix, those fears are hardly limited to South Korea.
It's this real sense that the ice is very, very thin, and the raft of money you've built could go under at any moment.
Which brings us to director Bong Joon-ho's second film recommendation.
The Secret Sunshine by Lee Chang-dong.
Secret Sunshine from 2007 stars two of the main actors in Parasite. It's about a widow's grief, and like Parasite, there's a shocking twist. All these movies face the fragility of what we'd call here the American dream, says Grady Hendrix, and perhaps that's propelled Parasite's success worldwide.
And if the movie has a thesis statement that's stated over and over throughout with all the subtlety of a concrete block being dropped on your head, it is that life laughs at your plans. Poor people shouldn't dream of being rich because you won't get there. Rich people shouldn't dream of safe because you aren't safe.
Still, director Bong Joon-ho says Parasite was intended to be bittersweet.
So I don't want to think that as a person or as a creator, I've become pessimistic about the world. But with Parasite, I really wanted to be honest. I didn't want to spread random hope to the audience. I really wanted to reflect the truth of our current times, and I think the ending of this film really reflects that as well.
And reflect them with a domestic gothic drama for the world. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
While the Oscars and the Golden Globes will honor the best films of the year, we're thinking bigger than a single year. We are considering what are the best films of the past decade. We ask the enigmatic Jeff Goldblum.
Well, favorite movies from this decade. Well, listen, this is going to sound self-serving and awful, but there are a couple that I'm in, believe it or not. I think that Wes Anderson is a genius, and I've been lucky enough to be in a couple this decade. The Grand Budapest Hotel, I think, is a beautiful, beautiful work.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
And also Isle of Dogs is quite beautiful.
Canine saturation has reached epidemic proportions.
Oh, they're so personal, his movies, and of course stylishly unconventional and unique.
Trash Island becomes an exile colony. The Isle of Dogs.
Besides that, there's another movie that came out that I think is very artful and I like a lot just from the inside out. It's called The Mountain, and Rick Alverson directed it.
Do you believe your dreams are imaginary? Or that they're real? Real?
Besides that, the ones that I'm not in, let me see. You know what came to mind as I was thinking of this? I like Paul Thomas Anderson, another Anderson, and I like The Master.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man, just like you.
I do love his kind of political awareness and the how they touch on the American story, that part of the American story that is complicated and sometimes darkish.
Good science, by definition, allows for more than one opinion.
Which is why our gathering of data is so far-reaching.
Otherwise, you merely have the will of one man, which is the basis of cult.
I would love to work with him. I liked Inherent Vice. I liked all of his movies. Boogie Nights is, of course, great. I just think he's very special. He admired somebody that I worked with, and I think worked with him a little bit, with Robert Altman. I did four movies with Robert Altman. I was so lucky to encounter him early in my career. You should never name drop. You know who told me that? Robert De Niro.
Actor Jeff Goldblum on some of his favorite movies from the 2010s. You can share your favorites with us on Twitter. We're at Morning Edition.
You're chuckling because Robert De Niro gives you advice all the time.
Right, every day. Sure. Every day.
This afternoon, in All Things Considered, 2019 is the year of TikTok. Why does a viral video app owned by a Chinese company cause such anxiety in Washington? Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. And join us this afternoon for BBC News Hour beginning at 3, followed by All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. It's a minute before 9 now. The latest news from NPR and WPR is just ahead.
Support for WPR comes from Roth Cheese, maker of specialty cheeses for holiday celebrations. Handcrafted in Wisconsin and available at grocers throughout the state. Holiday entertaining tips and more are at rothcheese.com.
Support comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Why not give the gift of peace of mind? Pre-plan your funeral arrangements with their caring, compassionate staff. They are dedicated to you, your family, and guests. 262-658-4101, KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.